table the story of our food, where it comes from, and how we make it. It may not be as wholesome as you think. In fact, some of our food is killing us and killing our planet. So says one of America's preeminent food writers in a new book, Animal, Vegetable, Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. It's a sweeping history of how we feed ourselves from the ancient wheat fields of Mesopotamia to the cornfields of the American Midwest to the fallacy of the meatless burger. We're going to explore food today on Frank Buckley Interviews, including we'll take a critical bite of the idea of that meatless burger with our guest, the longtime columnist for the New York Times, lead magazine, food writer, Mark Bittman. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Frank. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. I'm going to ask you about your provocative series of tweets the other day about fake meat, in which you said fake meat isn't better for animals. We'll get to that in just a few moments. But first, let's talk about this deep dive into food. The title of your book is Animal, Vegetable, Junk. We know the first two. What's the junk?
Well, junk is what we think it is. It's food that didn't exist 100 years ago, food that was mostly invented in the 20th century, food that you or I could never approach making, food that contains weird non-food ingredients, food our grandparents wouldn't recognize. We know what junk is. There's no strict definition of it, but the official term that people are using now is ultra-processed food. And the bad news is that 60% of our calories come from that kind of food, and it's not good for us. It's not nutritious.
Yeah, this ultra-processed this ultra-processed food, UPFs. If you just take the time to look at the list of ingredients, the amount of sugar and salt, and let's talk sugar and its effect on diseases like type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension. It is literally killing us, isn't it?
I mean, that B-roll is so telling because that is what a supermarket looks like. And we are told we have choice, but so much of our choice is among bad ingredients. To answer your question, 1.5 million Americans die every year as a result of chronic disease. And the chronic disease, you might call it an environmental disease or lifestyle disease, preventable disease, really. The leading driver of chronic disease is diet. And the leading driver of bad diet is sugar, junk food, and sugar in particular, but junk food in general.
But for a second, let me be the guy from the food industry who says, okay, you complain about, you know, the sugar and the salt. The consumer wants this, and we have a big job to do. We've got to feed 7 billion people. You can't do it with the little plot of land that you used to have in the backyard. We've got to create large quantities of food and distribute it across a globe, and this is the way that we've done it.
Good imitation, Frank. You should be pleased with yourself. It's not up to us to feed the world. It's up to people to feed themselves. I'm not saying up to individuals, but it isn't up for American agriculture and American food companies to feed 7 billion people. It's up to American legislators to make it so that we can determine what food is good for us and to start producing that. The food companies are not interested in feeding us nutritiously. They're interested in making money. That is their nature. What we need is to stop subsidizing the production of food that's not good for us and start promoting the agriculture and the distribution and the processing of food that is good for us.
But the legislators would, okay, now I'm going to play the role of the congressman from the who represents an agriculture area. I am representing my constituents, my farmers who need to create product, and this there is a market for their goods, and so I am supporting them in meeting that market, and this is how we're doing it. That's not a very good impression.
You're supporting them, Mr. Senator. because their lobbyists are the ones who are supporting your campaign. So now we're on to an issue of electoral reform, you know, which I'm happy to talk about, but it's not a food issue. The fact that California, where you're sitting, has 40 million people and two senators, and Iowa has something like 4 million people and two senators, that is a problem. Populous states are underrepresented, and farm states, relatively speaking, are overrepresented. But if you talk to any big farmer, he will say, I'll grow what I'm paid to grow. And what they're being paid to grow right now is corn and soybeans. And that corn and soybeans is what's used for animal feed to produce the tortured animals, of which we raise 10 billion a year or so. And that corn and soybeans is used to produce junk food, which is driving a huge public health crisis, as we talked about a few minutes ago.
Well, take me through the argument then. How could we possibly get back to that place where you did have family farmers who were able to have a sustainable living, to create foods that fed their families and their communities? How could we possibly go back to that, given the size of agribusiness today?
I mean, I don't think it's going back. It's going forward. And we have to move forward one step at a time. We're not going to dismantle industrial agriculture tomorrow and redistribute the land so that there are, again, 25% of the country is farmers. But we can make land available to people who want to farm it and farm it well. We can cut back on pesticides. We can cut back on industrial production of animals. We can do a number of things. We can take antibiotics out of the food supply. We can stop pushing junk food on our children in schools and outside of schools. All of these steps are going to lead toward a better food system. What it looks like 20 or 50 years down the road, I can't say. But it can't look like 1,000-acre farms growing corn and soybeans, because that is destroying our soil, it's destroying our air, it's destroying our land, and it's destroying our health. Mm.
You talk about the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in your book, and my sense is you're not a fan of the USDA. At least you were not many years ago. Has it reformed? Is it more of an advocate for the American consumer today? And tell me why you were critical of the USDA.
I mean, the USDA, I don't want to demonize the USDA, but the USDA has two conflicting missions. One is to promote American agriculture, and the other is to educate American eaters on how to eat well. Those are in conflict, because the kind of agriculture that USDA has always promoted has been the kind of agriculture that would make America powerful, that could be sold on the world market, that could be used to dominate trade and even to dominate other countries. That is not in our interests as eaters. It may be in the interests of big farms, of the manufacturers of equipment, as you're seeing here, of manufacturers of pesticides and chemical fertilizer, but it's not in the interest of eaters. We need nutritious food, food that's good for us. We need agriculture that's not contributing to climate change and not destroying the soil. We need a mode of producing animals that will produce healthier animals and will produce animals that are better for us. I mean, it's a question of what we want to prioritize. If we want to prioritize good food for everyone, that's a different role than USDA has been playing up until now.
Are there some rules that we can adopt when we go shopping? When Mark Bittman goes to the supermarket, and I suspect you spend a lot of time at farmers markets and places like that, but when you do go to the supermarket, where do I find you? What are you taking home?
I mean, what I'm not taking home, I go back to that brilliant B-roll you opened with. What I'm not taking home is anything from the snack aisle and the soda aisle and the prepared foods aisles and so on. I'm taking home ingredients, for the most part, that don't need labels, that I can cook with. But look, Frank, I would agree that not everyone can cook. Not everyone has choice. Not everyone has the time to cook the way that I do. We need to make it so that good food, real food, is available, affordable, accessible to everyone in this country, not just people who have the time and the know-how and the money to go to a farmer's market or even go to a supermarket and buy carefully selected ingredients, bring them home, cook them, and so on. We have, you know, what is the percentage of people in this country working two jobs, 20, 25%? What is the percentage of people working for at or near the poverty line? These are people who cannot afford the time and often the money to go shopping, go cooking, do things well. Good food is really hard to come by for those people.
Yeah, it sure is. And that's one of the things that you do talk about a great deal in your book. We're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Impossible Whopper, fake meat. Isn't it better for animals? Mark Bittman says, no, it isn't. We'll ask him why when we come back.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And we're back with Mark Bittman, author of the new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Mark, you've been a longtime proponent of eating less meat. Why?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Although I don't think meat is turning out to be quite as bad for us as was once thought, it's not as good for us as food from the vegetable kingdom, from the plant kingdom. But the real reason is we are raising and killing upwards of 10 billion animals a year, and they are raised in horrible conditions that few of us know anything about and few of us ever see. And they're raised using the same corn and soybeans that goes into junk food, which dominates. That kind of agriculture is dominating the American landscape. It's using chemical fertilizer, it's using chemical pesticides, it's responsible for us losing topsoil, and this kind of animal production is one of the primary contributors to climate change in agriculture today. So everyone responsible, everyone without a vested interest in us eating more animal products agrees that we'd be better off eating fewer. I'm not saying eating none, I'm saying eating less. Mm.
To that end, I thought, oh, Mark Bittman's going to love the Impossible Burger, Beyond Meat, all of this fake meat. But the other day, you went off on Twitter about the Impossible Whopper. Here's one of the tweets that you wrote the other day. Here's what fake meat success looks like. The Impossible Whopper costs as much as three times more to make than a regular Whopper, costs a dollar or two more at the drive-thru, and parallels the nutritional value of a regular Whopper, which is next to nothing. How can this be? We're not eating an animal. Isn't this better?
Well, it's definitely better in the sense that it's not eating meat. A friend of mine, David Katz, who's a doctor, says, what are you eating it instead of? If you're eating an Impossible Whopper instead of a Whopper, the bar is pretty low. I mean, the Whopper is really among the worst foods you can eat. So if you're eating an imitation Whopper, okay, you didn't kill an animal to make that particular Whopper. But other than that, there are no advantages. You know, here's the thing about the new fake meats. The consumption of meat in the United States has not gone down since their introduction. So they're successful in the sense that they are selling and they're making money for their creators. But they're not successful in the sense that people are eating less meat. We're not. The way to eat less meat is to eat less meat. Mm. And there are plenty of things we can be eating that are much closer to natural than an Impossible Whopper or anything in that world.
All right. Tell me what they are.
Well, I would start with legumes, which is nature's way of providing protein. The legume or bean or lentil, whatever you want to call it, is the most important protein source in the world. It's a near perfect food. It doesn't kill animals. It's easy to grow. By the way, the main ingredient in fake meat is legumes or protein derived from legumes. It's just that it's processed to death to the point where this fake meat is closer in nature to ultra processed food, the kind of junk food we were talking about before, than it is to either meat or plant.
Hmm. But is it a matter of refinement? That is, okay, this is first generation fake meat. Isn't this the future? Isn't this more sustainable? Doesn't it help in terms of greenhouse gases and that sort of thing, in terms of our environment, ultimately, for us to move away from meat to synthetic meat?
I think it helps us to move away from meat to other foods. Mm. And I think those foods should be real foods. And I think those foods should be close to natural. And I think that if we teach our children what real food is, instead of teaching them that Pepsi is the most fun beverage to drink and McDonald's is the place to bug your parents to take you on a Sunday afternoon, and Oreo is the most fun food you could buy. If we teach our children that real food tastes good, is good for us, is good for the planet, then we'll start to raise generations of adults who don't crave junk food, who actually understand what real food is and want to eat that. Yeah. I mean, we can't stop eating meat by creating fake meat. We're going to stop eating meat by eating things other than meat, which are plants.
Mm. Plants and things that when we go to the market, I try now to be a smarter consumer. And one of the things I look for is the word organic. You say in your book that organic isn't always organic. Tell me what you mean.
Well, organic, there's a legal definition. And we have to hope that there are enough inspectors in USDA, despite cutbacks over the years, so that the legal definition is met. But as with any legal definition, this can be toyed with. I think the spirit of organic is to raise food in harmony with nature, without torturing animals, without using chemical pesticides, without using chemical fertilizer, with care for the soil, with care for the crops, with care for the eater and the worker. That is the spirit of organic. I think that spirit is defied when you see, I don't want to use brand names, but when you see organic hard seltzer, for example, or when you see even organic grapes flown in from Chile, whose carbon cost is enormous. When you don't know anything about labor practices or what actually the ingredients are or what the sum total is. I mean, my friend Marion Nestle says, and this is one of the great quotes of all time, organic junk food is still junk food. And that's, you know, if you're going to the supermarket and looking for organic vegetables, I applaud you. If you're going to the supermarket and looking for organic shampoo, I'm not sure it matters that much.
All right. We're going to take one more quick break. When we get back, more with the food writer and journalist Mark Bittman. I'm going to ask him what we can do on an individual basis to make things better.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with Mark Bittman. And Mark, we've discussed all the issues related to food and the things that are killing us. And so if I don't want to kill myself with the food that I'm eating and what I'm buying at the store, and I want to help farmers and I want to help the environment, give me a roadmap. Give me a plan. Tell me what Mark Bittman is doing so that I can do it.
I mean, the thing is that when I say eat well, eat a good diet, everyone knows what that means at this point. I mean, to sum it up, it means eat as many foods from the plant kingdom in as unprocessed or minimally processed form as possible. Cut way back on junk food and cut back as much as you're comfortable with on animal products. Okay, so if we have that straight, that's kind of the beginning of your roadmap. Now, if you want to, as you, Frank, said, you do buy organic, if you want to shop at a farmer's market, if you want to join a CSA, a community-supported agriculture, where you're basically paying farmers in advance for a share of this year's crop. These are all great things. But I don't also encourage people to get involved with how does your city or town buy food for its institutions? What's happening in your kids' school? What is zoning like in your town? How easy is it for people to buy and start good new farms? What does your legislature think about? Your legislator think about food? What is your legislator angling for on the state level or in Congress? These are important things for us to do too. It's not just about how we eat, it's how we act and think about the future.
A lot of folks know you from you cooking, and they wonder, what does Mark Bittman do when it comes to preparing a meal or planning a week's meals? Does a lot of thought go into it?
I mean, a week, no way. It's a day-to-day thing for me. And I basically, if I'm at a market, I buy what looks good. But more often than not, I'm looking in the refrigerator, I'm looking in the pantry, I'm looking in the freezer, and I'm saying, this is as good as it's going to get.
Give us a go-to. I mean, everyone has a breast of chicken in their fridge. Give us a couple of go-tos that are easy and
well. I don't have chicken in a breast of chicken in my fridge. I have whole chicken in my fridge or in my freezer. I tend to have go-tos. I mean, there's so much stuff here. I do cook pasta once or twice a week because I really like it. We do have chicken once a week or so. There's a lot of stir fries. It's not that, I don't think it's that unusual. I think really at this point unless I have a specific goal in mind, I'm kind of accomplished, but average home cook.
And do you feel more satisfaction when you have something or create something on the fine dining side versus something simple and rustic? Does it matter to you?
I just don't do fine dining. I do like it when I've been on sort of a ramen from scratch kind of thing. Mm. Not really ramen, but rice noodles in broth with a bunch of different things. And it gets very creative in that I'm using whatever's on hand and whatever looks good. And I mean, sometimes they're really beautiful, but they're incredibly simple. And I like doing stuff like that. I mean, I like doing things that I'm not that are new, but that they're not in the routine and are a little bit out of the ordinary. But I really don't get fancy.
Yeah. I mean, let me put it to you this way. For me, on a daily basis, I make an omelet, and it's more frittata-like than omelet-like, but I love a nice frittata sort of omelet. Nancy Silverton, the celebrated LA chef,
yep.
I asked her what you know, I could make that she makes. And she gave me her recipe for her oven thighs, her staff oven thighs. So this is the meal that's cooked for the staff. And it has become one of my go-tos. It feels a little fancy, you know, because you're putting herbs, you're making the thighs on top of a bed of onions and lemons and some herbs, salt and pepper. But it was quite simple at the end of the day. And that has become sort of a go-to. Does Mark Bittman, I don't know what else I'm going to do. I'm going to just do this tonight, the thing that I do six times a month.
Well, there isn't something like that. But if you're looking for something that you can do that I do a lot is steam fish on a bed of greens. And before we started talking officially, you were talking about cooking beds of greens. And I really love taking whatever cooking greens are around, cooking them in olive oil, a little water, maybe shallot or garlic, maybe some herbs. And then when they're done, putting a piece of fish on top, covering it, and then just cooking that for 5 minutes or however long it takes to finish the fish.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to try that.
That's really good.
And
we did that the
other
night with...
Yeah.
We did that the other night with the first spinach of the year. I'm back east, obviously, and some salmon from Alaska, and it was awesome.
Excellent. And I'm going to tell everyone Mark Bittman taught me how to make this personally. So that'll be great. Thank you very much. Mark, I really appreciate the time. The book, once again, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And if you're not a subscriber, I hope you'll do it today. It's free, of course, and it'll ensure that you won't miss a single episode of our podcast, which drops every week on Wednesday. We have some 240 episodes in our archives that you can listen to at any time on demand. You can also see our interviews on KTLA on the weekends and on YouTube. As always, thanks for sharing us on social media with your friends. Tag me when you do. I'm Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.